You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Well, good morning, everyone. I'm Ashley Tellis, a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment, and I want to take the opportunity to welcome all of you here this morning to this event that we are going to do in two parts today. First, an address by the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition and Technology, Dr. Ashton Carter, followed by a discussion on the report which has been released and which I think you will have copies of, looking at the Indian combat acquisition, where the U.S. obviously has very important stakes. But let me start by congratulating you for having survived the great travails in Washington this morning and actually having made it in here. It's, you know, there are few things that can bring the city to its knees. I mean, we've gone through wars, we've gone through terrorist attacks, but half an inch of snow is conclusive enough. And for those of you who have survived it, well, congratulations and thank you for coming. In many ways, this is an auspicious day for other reasons as well. This is today the anniversary of India's founding as a constitutional democracy in 1950. It's India's Republic Day. And it's actually one of India's most important political holidays, because the Indian state today celebrates the fact that it is a democracy just like us. And it's a good day on which to meet to discuss the subject that we're going to discuss, because Indian democracy is what makes India so attractive to us as a partner. It's also the reason why the United States has reached out over the last two decades to build this new relationship with India. It's the reason why we've put our best foot forward in terms of our aircraft in the Mulka competition. And it's the reason why over the last two decades we have developed a very important set of relations, including in strategic areas like defense. And this morning, to speak on that broad issue of U.S.-India defense relations, where we are and where we are going, we have actually my personal friend and a dear colleague, Dr. Ashton Carter. You have his bio in front of you. It's a long bio. I'm not going to take the time to read it all, but I do want to say a few things of a personal nature to embarrass him as well. Ash is a distinguished public servant. He has spent many years in the U.S. government in an early incarnation as the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy, and today as the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition Technology. That is another long-winded way of saying that today he's in the eye of the storm, because the United States has very specific challenges at this moment in its history. We have to protect the capabilities that make us what we are in a budgetary environment that is extraordinarily difficult and in a global environment that is extremely challenging. And the gentleman who has the responsibility for making certain that our armed forces have the tools they need is right here at this table. And that's what he does day in and day out. He brings, of course, a wealth of experience to this position, but the circumstances that the country faces today are not the best compared to the circumstances we've experienced for the last 60 years. But Ash brings to the job a great deal of diligence, intelligence, and integrity. And so the first point to keep in mind is he's a distinguished public servant. We are delighted to have him with us here today. Second point, he's also a distinguished academic. And his important positions in public office sometimes obscure the fact that before he came here, he spent many years at the Kennedy School and working with Secretary Perry as the co-director of the Preventive Defense Project. In fact, Ash has written seminal works that to this day still remain reference tomes in their own right. I have to tell you, I'm currently working on a manuscript on Indian missile defense. And I frequently find myself going back to two volumes that Ash edited 20 years ago. One on ballistic missile defense, published by the institution next door, which I dare not name as long as I'm on this podium. And another volume on managing nuclear operations, which to this day, in my judgment, represents the only book which has serious honest-to-goodness analysis of what nuclear operations entail. I mean, that's a book that will never go out of style. I hope it has made you a lot of money, Ash, because with the kind of environment that we have, it's going to become even more important. So Ash has had a whole record of distinguished writing. He worked, of course, in Cambridge for many years, was deeply associated with National Security, which is the premier journal in the field, and I hope we'll find time to continue to write at some point in the future. And the third point I want to make is that Ash is a distinguished strategist who has given a great deal of thought to the challenges facing international security. He did a lot of work with the Aspen Strategy Group, and it was my privilege many years ago when I was working with Ambassador Blackwell in India to welcome Ash and the Aspen Strategy Group to India for the first time. In fact, it was a very important meeting because it led the way to a very serious dialogue between Indian and American strategists, which continues to this day. For all his endeavors, he has been recognized by the Department of Defense with the Distinguished Service Medal, the Intelligence Medal, and has, of course, been a confidant to many secretaries, including the current Secretary of Defense. The United States has been blessed over the years. In fact, I think back to Bob McNamara, with building a tradition of people who have come into public service with rich experience in either the physical or the social sciences. And they have brought to their jobs in government the knowledge that they have developed in the academy and the vision that they have had time to develop when outside of public office. Ash Carter really represents the epitome and the continuation of that tradition. So we have no better individual this morning to really reflect on the issues of U.S.-India defense relations, a subject we will hear much about in the years to come. And so on behalf of the Carnegie Endowment, you and me personally, Ash Carter, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, my friend Ashley, for that wonderful introduction and for your wonderful friendship over many years. Ashley has lots of talents, and I'm going to refer to some of them in the U.S.-India context shortly, but he and my wife enjoy cooking, and that's every once in a while when we're together, I can get a word in edgewise on strategy or India or something like that, but mostly it's cooking. He's right. He and Bob Blackwell hosted me and the Aspen Strategy Group in Udaipur way back when, in the early days when Bob and Ashley were coining phrases, they all stick in my mind. Dehyphenation was one. Flat as a chapati was another one. He was central to the opening of our relationship in all fields with India, but importantly in security. He was central to the nuclear deal, which was a move of great symbolic importance. They can also have great practical importance. And the things that Ashley did with Bob in those days were the catalysts of the inauguration of the U.S.-India relationship. And he deserves great credit for the vision and the energy that went into that beginning that took something that had a latent logic and opened it up and turned it into action. And those important early ingredients and catalysts remain ingredients today, and in the meantime, much more has been added to the agenda. Ashley himself remains an influential voice, and I commend to your attention today the report, a very thoughtful paper on the Indian Mamurka acquisition. Of course, I had no view on that before I read the study, but schooled myself on it and learned a great deal and found myself persuaded. I'll say more on that shortly. But anyway, for all these reasons, I thank Ashley, and I am not as familiar as he, but very familiar with the wonders of India, with the logic and momentum behind the U.S.-India relationship, and especially its security dimension. It is the 62nd Republic Day. What is happening there is a 21-gun salute. That I can do. I can't unfurl the Indian flag, but we do have 21 guns. But instead, I thought I would accept his invitation to be with you today to discuss our defense relationships between what is sure to be, and President Obama and Secretary Gates have both used this phrase, one of the defining partnerships of the 21st century. President Obama, during his visit to India in November, emphasized how broad and deep were the intersections of our two countries. In trade and technology, in the promotion of democracy and pluralism, and my subject today, international security affairs. Naturally, I'll focus on security, and I'm going to ask you to look with me today through the lens of the Undersecretary for Acquisition Technology and Logistics. And in order to do that, you have to know what the Undersecretary of Acquisition Technology and Logistics is. Now, some of us know, but my children didn't, and they asked me when I took this job, what is the Undersecretary for Acquisition? They said that the title's too long. Nobody's ever heard of it. And why can't you be CIA director? And if you have the same questions, let me tell you what the Undersecretary for Acquisition Technology and Logistics does. My office is responsible essentially for the management of the resources of the department, particularly that $400 billion of the $700 billion total that is not spent on manpower, salaries of uniformed and civilian people and their benefits, but on goods and services. So all of our major weapons acquisition programs. Logistics, I'll say more about that shortly, but all of our logistics systems and activities and operations around the world. Our bases, all of our installations, the largest real estate holding in the world by the Department of Defense, the nuclear arsenal, other weapons of mass destruction, counter weapons of mass destruction related things, missile defense, our technology base, energy, environment, because our installations and programs touch the energy and environmental issues many places around the world. So this is what USD AT&L does, and it's all of those areas are ones in which we have and are forming cooperative activities with India. In fact, in a few weeks, I'll be traveling to India, and this made this particularly propitious timing. It'd be not by any means my first trip to India, but my first trip to India in this job, and I look forward to returning there and from this position working to increase the pace and depth of our security cooperation. Secretary Gates was recently in the region, and as I said, will be going to India in just a few weeks' time. Several weeks ago, I was in a different part of Asia, and let me tell you a little something about that trip. It'll give you some idea of what the preoccupations of someone in my job are on the road, and then you'll be able to see where we're headed with India. I was over in East Asia on that last trip, starting at Pearl Harbor and our Pacific Command there. And there, my responsibilities are to support the operational commanders there and make sure that they have everything they need if any contingency should arise in that region. Thence to Guam, where you may know a lot of activity there. First of all, a very substantial building project going on up at Anderson Air Force Base on the northern tip of Guam. The Global Hawk has just arrived in Guam. Down in the southwest at OPERA, the naval facility there, substantial refurbishment of our naval base there on Guam, preparation for carrier berthing, submarine berthing on Guam, and then, of course, the planned repositioning of 10,000-ish Marines from Okinawa, the Futenma facility at Okinawa, to the island of Guam, which really involves, for my purposes, the building of a miniature city for those Marines and their families and dependents. And with all that goes the schools and the commissaries and the athletic facilities and so forth, in addition to the housing for those families. Then on to the Republic of Korea, where we are rebasing our forces, moving them south of the Han River, those that were scattered along the DMZ at the end of the Korean War, and for operational reasons and family reasons, moving them to Camp Humphreys down south of the Han. So once again, building a city of 60,000 with all of the facilities attendant thereto. And that is progressing very well. Then over to Japan, where we have the Futenma replacement facility plan and a host of cooperative activities with the government of Japan as it repositions its own forces increasingly to the southern islands. Then on to Alaska and Fort Greely, which is the missile defense site from which we defend North America, principally from trajectories in that particular location originating in North Korea, but elsewhere also a very substantial facility up near Fairbanks. And also the principal air bases from which forces would flow and through which forces would flow in the event of contingencies in East Asia. So I say all this just to give you a sense of the momentum and the amount of activity, the surge, so to speak, the tremendous buildup of activity that we have going on. I've dealt with East Asia now, but that swings around into Southeast Asia and the Indian Ocean, and it's that arc that will be the subject of my upcoming trip, but very similar kind of activity, activities there. I want to emphasize all of this amount of activity in the Pacific and Indian Oceans because so many people think we're preoccupied with CENTCOM and we're not paying attention to anything else. Nothing could be further from the truth, and that those examples illustrate that, and I think what you see on the upcoming trip by me and some other U.S. government officials in India will underscore that. But not irrelevant to U.S.-India relations, CENTCOM is important. And I spend a lot of my time, it won't surprise you to learn, on and in Afghanistan. I'll tell you some of the things that are going on there, again, from my perspective, to my delight and really to the great credit of our logistics, our logisticians. We accomplished the surge by the end of August, which the president directed us to begin last December. If you'd asked me last December, were we going to get all that stuff in there by the end of August, I would have broken into a sweat. But through very hard work, we got all of the uplift forces into Afghanistan, the enablers that go with them, which are still flowing in, and, of course, accomplished all the normal rotations of the forces that were already there. So substantial movement of people and equipment during that 10-month period, all successful and on time. I am responsible for contractors on the battlefield, which you probably have perceived as a very tricky task, and we have substantial activities now in Afghanistan, both in support of our forces, in support of allied forces, in support of Afghan security forces, including the building of the installations from which the Afghan security forces, Afghan army and national police, border patrol operate, the training and equipping of those forces, very substantial projects in the area of aid, both from USAID and through various other agencies, including the Department of Defense. So very, very substantial volume of activity. And then finally, of course, not surprising, providing all the equipment that our forces need to be effective and to minimize casualties. These are like the MRAP vehicles, which we last summer, I signed on June 30th the authorization to begin building the MRAP ATV, all-terrain vehicle, specially designed for the Afghan terrain. And we have fielded in the hands of soldiers in Afghanistan more than 7,000 MRAP ATVs and more on the way, as well as a host of other MRAP family of vehicles variants. Counter IED equipment of all kinds, all sorts of detectors from fancy airplanes to the oldest detector of nitrogenous material in the world, the dog, which remains the most sensitive. They've spent a lot of time perfecting their techniques, and they turn out to be extremely good when it comes to homemade explosives. And for someone who spends most of his time buying fighter aircraft, I've now learned how to buy dogs, which is tricky, and to field dogs, which is even trickier. But they're an important component, and then all the intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance and so forth that goes with being there. So a lot going on, quite obviously. Then in India is, we all recognize, critical to our success in Afghanistan in so many ways, since its historical links with Afghanistan and Pakistan run so deep. And since our history in the same region is and will be long-lasting, because the effects we're seeking there are long-lasting effects, we can benefit from the insights and, above all, the assistance of India. And India is being supportive in a number of ways, to include a substantial development assistance in Afghanistan. But the centerpiece of my attention in that region at the moment, and certainly on this trip, will be the U.S.-India defense relationship. And here also there's a lot going on. But there can and should be more. Let me describe some of what's going on and then our aspirations for building on it, starting with exercises, which are important in their own right to prepare for emergencies that we in the Indian Armed Forces might need to deal with shoulder to shoulder, and also important for their potential to familiarize one military with the other and therefore open up yet other dimensions of cooperation. And our military exercise plan, which I'm sure many of you have seen, has grown in size and scope and sophistication since really Ashley got it started back in 2005. We now have regular exercises. We have them all across all services. My understanding is that India conducts more joint exercises with the United States than with any other country. And that's a wonderful thing. The complexity of the exercises is increasing as we get more and more familiar each with the other's concept of operations. We also have a whole host of bilateral exchanges, staff talks, and so forth. And as Secretary Flournoy has emphasized just a few months ago, we also look forward to a more multilateral activity involving India amongst regional militaries in anticipation of responding to events like the tsunami, that kind of thing. And all this is good, but Prime Minister Singh and President Obama have urged us to look further and higher, and we are. And they've both noted that really cementing a strong bilateral defense relationship requires more than formal visits and dialogues and even exercises. They want to create conditions where close U.S.-India defense cooperation is, and these are the phrases, normal, expected, and routine. And we so regard them, particularly the expected part, which, since that's our boss, we got the expected part. And we're working on the normal and routine. A particular focus, there are lots of ones, but given the maritime geography and histories of both of our countries is maritime security. That's a natural for us and a big theme. Another natural for us, being both innovative and generally highly educated and technically educated populations, is science and technology cooperation, and my science and technology-based folks are also working very closely with their counterparts in India. Both the way these things usually work is they begin with an exchange of information and then move on to the definition of joint projects. And in a number of cases, we have moved on to that latter phase with India already. We obviously regard India as a capable and really formidable partner in science and technology, given the sophistication of the Indian science and technology base. We have six technology areas that we focus on with India, those being synthetic biology, quantum information science, cognitive neuroscience, models of human behavior, engineered materials, nanoscience, and nanotechnology. All very promising areas, all very far-looking and far-reaching areas, and our people working in those fields, the people who work for me in those fields and their Indian counterparts are discussing, more importantly, formulating joint projects in those areas. For us, we're in it not just for the relationship, but because we as Ashley indicated, are looking to operate more efficiently and apply savings within our own department to force structure and modernization, and it makes sense for us, therefore, to leverage our science and technology dollars within with our international partners, and that also reflects the inherent globalization of the technology base. So there's a logic in there for us. Navy, not surprisingly, I mentioned maritime security, probably the most active among our services in this area, and exchanges of scientists and engineers and so forth. So quite a bit of going on in that second area after exercises, which is science and technology cooperation. Let me now turn to armaments cooperation. I am the National Armaments Director of the United States. And So I look at these things. I put myself in the shoes of my Indian counterparts and try to imagine, well, they're thinking their way through their problems in the same way that I think my way through my problems. And I'll tell you a few of my own perspectives on this. The first is with respect to globalization. We look at globalization in defense as something that is important industrially as well as geopolitically. Globalization obviously affects all of commerce. Defense is no different. We cannot wall ourselves off or avoid globalization in defense. A substantial and increasing, this many people don't know this, but a substantial and increasing amount of the value added in the goods and services that we buy in the Department of Defense is in fact sourced overseas, just like much of what you buy in Best Buy is sourced overseas. Sometimes that's because that's where the best technology can be found or the best value can be found. And when it is, we owe it to the warfighter and the taxpayer, who are my clients, to find it wherever it is around the world. So for us, globalization of our market isn't an option. It's a reality. And we are also committed to competition in our procurement process, and that includes being open to competition from what are called non-heritage companies. That's another important force for value for our taxpayer and our warfighter. We're committed to continuing also to open our markets, at the same time striking the appropriate balance with security concerns where we have them. So we open up our markets. We encourage our counterparts to open up their markets likewise. Exports are important to us. They obviously strengthen our own industry, but also strengthen international security when they, in turn, enhance the capabilities of security partners around the world. So both for industrial reasons and for security reasons, we export our systems even as we import systems made abroad. We have tried to back up, in the case of India, that pledge with our licensing process. That's a constant source of frustration, but it's one that we work on and work on very assiduously with respect to India. I think Secretary Gates has made it pretty clear that he's committed to reforming the export controls process to make it more conducive to partnership building. I can't remember his exact words, but they have been very sharp to us about who manage the export control system, and things like antiquated come to mind, I think, in his the verbal assaults he has made upon export control system we inherited. So we're doing a lot to try to create a streamlined process for export controls, and that also will be an important factor in U.S.-India relationships. So that's sort of the background as I look at the international scene when it comes to arms sales. With respect to India, you may not know this, but there's also already been a substantial amount of activity in the years since Ashley opened these doors. The first one, I think it was the first one, was the sale of the LPD Trenton to India, which was back in 2007. Then the purchase of, I think, six C-130Js, excellent turboprop transport aircraft. I think the first of those is delivered early this year, if I'm right about that. Next is the P-8, and there's a contract there for eight P-8s. We, too, will be buying P-8s. P-8 program is performing very well, and I'm very pleased with it on our behalf. I think the Indians will be pleased with it on their behalf. Harpoon missiles, also a transaction underway. So there's been a lot of activity already. There are several large ones pending. One is the subject of Ashley's report today, namely the medium multi-role combat aircraft, or MMRCA, competition, which is for 126 combat aircraft with a value of more than $10 billion. And there are a number of entrants into that competition. From the U.S., the F-16 and the F-18 aircraft, and then the Eurofighter, Rafale, MiG-35, and Gripen. So a total of six aircraft in that competition. And as I said, I tried to put myself, as I was reading Ashley's report, in the shoes of my counterparts trying to make this decision in India, and sort of reason through this the way the way I reasoned through our own purchases here. And I would say the following about the MMRCA possibilities. I think that, without saying anything disparaging about the other entrants, both the F-18 and the F-16 offers include the best technology. I think we have been very forthcoming and forward-leaning with respect to technology, with respect to technology transfer, and also industrial participation. All of those are important. And I say that it's not just important for the sake of a single transaction, but that's the kind of thing that draws us together closer as two countries. So I would say that they should make their decisions on this technology, tech transfer, and industrial participation, number one. A second thing that I think is important and I'm committed to in our process, both with respect to India and in our own internal process, is an open and transparent process. And I think we can promise the Indian government that as well. And that's important. It's important to us who have a public trust. And then the third thing that I always pay attention to is life cycle sustainment and upgrades. Some of you may not know this, but in general, for a major system, some 70% of the life cycle cost of the system is in the sustainment, not in the initial development or purchase of the article, but in its sustainment over time. So you really have to pay attention to what you're getting in that area. And whether you're attaching yourself to a very substantial global base, which is what one is doing in the case of the F-18 and the F-16, and an affordable sustainment program, and also the possibility for periodic upgrades, because the game changes all the time. You want to have aircraft that have the capacity at an industrial base that has the capacity to keep up with upgrades over time. So those are the three dimensions that I would look at. I think they're well represented in Ashley's analysis as well. India will make its decisions based upon its own needs and its own assessment of those three factors. And our relationship will go on in the defense field, whatever happens. Obviously, I hope that we end up being their partner because it would give additional momentum to the relationship. But there's plenty of momentum in the relationship, however one particular transaction comes out. I should also mention the C-17, which has been a very successful airplane for us. We have enough of them. It's not that we don't like them, but we have enough of them. They, together with our C-5 fleet and our C-130 fleet, round out and, in fact, somewhat exceed our requirements for airlift. And so we aren't going to be buying any more C-17s, but India and other countries will be, and that's an aircraft that's worked out very well for us. The Light Combat Aircraft Engine Program, which is a GE engine program, is another one that is out there in the offing, which I think is going to be important. The M777 howitzer also, the Hawker Beechcraft trainers, and the Jaguar engine upgrade program for the Jaguar engines that are there. These are just a few of the things that are in discussion between U.S. and Indian industry. All important things and just symptoms of or signs of our increasing industrial relationship, even as we have an increasing strategic relationship. One last area that I thought I'd mention is cooperation between our two security establishments in the area of countering weapons of mass destruction. And you may not, this may not be on your radar screen, but it's a very important thing. And we have, for example, chemical and biological weapons. And there we discuss with India some of their activities that are along the same lines that we do in our own security establishment in the chem bio area. This is research and development in the area of biosurveillance, which has a lot in common with public health surveillance. The two complement one another, have some similar techniques. Medical countermeasures in the event of an incident of this kind. And so our public health interests on the one hand and our desire to make sure that we are able to respond to a biosecurity event involving infectious disease that is anthropogenic in nature, India shares those concerns, and that's a kind of new area that we're getting into now that I think will be very productive. So I could go on and on and on and on. There are lots of areas. But what you see here is, in the world that I inhabit of AT&L, a very substantial agenda of activity. It's very concrete. I hope you're not bored with it. It's what I do all day. I love it. But it is what follows in behind the realization by our leaders that logic is on the side and history is on the side of this relationship, both because of our economic interests, or all because of our economic interests, our convergence of values, democracy, pluralism, and third, our largely common security interests. So all these things bring us together. The note I want to close on is a challenge. I'm always looking ahead. I'm the doer. I always tell Secretary Gates, you're up there in the bridge. I'm down here in the engine room. And I look at our relationship with India the same way. The President, Prime Minister up there on the bridge. I'm down here in the engine room. And things down here, there in the engine room require constant effort and persistent effort. We've had a lot of headline-grabbing firsts in years past, and now we're down to the very satisfying but difficult work of making things happen. That's where I live. All of it is unprecedented. In most cases, each and everything we're trying to do, we haven't quite done yet before with India. And so we're all feeling our way along and trying to figure out how to make it work. So it's all unprecedented, but nothing is impossible or no problem is insurmountable. It's just a long slog to build that long-term, strong bilateral relationship. I'm absolutely confident that we will be able to do so. And that, as President Obama said, that as India's influence in the world continues to rise, so too will the opportunities for either even closer cooperation between our two countries. I'm committed to making that happen. I think the United States government is committed to making that happen. I salute one of the founders of that relationship on behalf of this country who's sitting here with me, Ashley Tellis. Ashley, we're endeavoring to carry forward your vision. Thank you for having me here today. Yeah. Thank you. On this subject.
Yeah. Ash, thank you very much. That was a wonderful presentation for at least one reason in my experience. When we end up talking about the U.S. and India, particularly from the defense perspective, the discussion always persists at the 80,000-foot level of strategy. And that's important. But what makes the relationship ultimately tick is what happens in the engine room with all the elbow grease and all the stuff that really keeps the ship moving. And I'm really grateful to Dr. Carter today for laying out things that are not in the public eye and that will hopefully give us time for reflection. Dr. Carter has kindly agreed to take a few questions before he leaves. I have one request of you, though. I know all of you are dying to figure out who the winner of the tanker program is in the U.S. Hold those questions for another day. If you could focus your attention today on the subject of the presentation, which is U.S.-India relations, I think that'll be productive both for the subject that we are discussing and for the program this morning. So I'll be happy to admit a few questions. Please identify yourself so that the Undersecretary knows who you are. Let me start with you, sir.
Rich Douglas, General Electric. You described a very positive trend in the U.S.-India. Described a very positive trend in the U.S.-India security relationship. As you look forward, do you see risks to that goodness? Those, you know, I guess I'd say circles of goodness. Anything out there on the horizon? And then, as a representative of defense industry, could you comment on what businesses or engagement in India? Should there be things we're doing more of, less of, doing differently to support the good work that DOD is doing with that with India?
Both good questions. I don't see any, and I'm not just saying this, clouds on the horizon. I think there is such a powerful logic. The deeper we look into this relationship, the more we find. The frustrations are mundane. We have two different administrative styles, largely unknown to one another, and so there's a lot of sort of groping in the dark to make things happen. But economically, strategically, politically in the largest sense, I don't see anything that doesn't make, you know, a Betty man or woman pretty certain about the U.S.-India relationship, and that's the reason why we're putting so many chips on. I think really the Indians are as well. To the business community in India, I mean, I think you're sort of where we are in government as well, it's just feeling your way along. You know, learning the ways of that country and its government in doing things which are different from ours, and we simply have to keep working through things. So I know there are frustrations, and it's true everywhere around the world. I mean, you ought to be trying to get stuff into Afghanistan. You know, so it's hard anywhere in the world, and we're difficult to work with as well. They find us frustrating also, but all of these are just practical problems, and nothing looms behind them.
The lady at the back, please.
Thank you. I'm Helen Raphael, Resources for the Future. I wonder if you could comment on the implications of our closer and closer military relationship with India for our relationships with China and Pakistan. You started out your talk talking about how we have military bases in an arc along China's coastline, and this is sort of an extension down to the Indian Ocean. And also, of course, Afghanistan depends so much on our relationship with Pakistan. And our relationships with China and Pakistan, therefore, are very important in the future.
I'll need to second what you just said, which is our relationship with China and Pakistan are important to us. Also, President Hu was just here, that's a different relationship. It has a different history, different dynamics, but also a very positive future as well, I think, a bit. And what's that? India and China have a complicated history, but not one that's all blemishes either. But we have a very productive relationship with each of them separately, and that's where we devote our attention. The same thing with Pakistan. I mean, we're working very closely with Pakistan now on a whole host of things. Obviously, Afghanistan, which is a subject of mutual importance, and on combating extremism within Pakistan, within the region, and around the world. So all three are very important countries to us. We have important interests that overlaps with all three of them. We have important activities underway with all three of them. There's no contradiction among those three relationships.
Yes.
Mike, can you wait for me? Dave Majumdar, Defense News. You're saying if the Indians pick the F-16 or F-A-18, that would give them the best technology. Would that eventually, if they pick the our aircraft, would that eventually be a bridge to the F-35 potentially, and then beyond that, co-developing maybe a sixth-generation fighter similar to how the Russians and the Indians are cooperating on the on their fifth-generation plane?
I don't know whether it'll be a bridge to the F-35. That's really up to the Indians. There's nothing on our side, no principle which bars that on our side, Indian participation in the Joint Strike Fighter program. Right now, they're focused on these aircraft, which are really top-of-the-line fourth-gen fighters, and they're good value and meet the requirements of the MMRCA solicitation there. But from our point of view, they haven't inquired about the Joint Strike Fighter, but as the acquisition executive of the United States, there's nothing in principle that bars Indian participation sometime in the future in JSF if they want to go that far.
At the end of the room, please.
Hi, John Schlosser from the Albright Stonebridge Group. In the previous administration, there was a rather intensive dialogue, at least for a couple of years, on missile defense cooperation. And you've written on that subject. And I just wondered, it seems to have tailed off for reasons of altered priorities on both sides. But I wonder if any thought is being given to reviving that, And also, any thoughts you might have on India's more practical interest in developing more sophisticated air and missile defense systems of its own. Thanks.
Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, that'll be something I'll be discussing when I'm in India shortly. I think where I'd start on integrated air and missile defense, probably where we have the most immediate common need would be in the maritime airspace management area. That's certainly an obvious place to start. But really, just across the spectrum, we're doing so much now internationally in the area of missile defense. Obviously, you're all aware of the European phased adaptive approach deployment, number of deployments into the CENTCOM area of responsibility, many requests in the Pacific, Japan, the Republic of Korea, and of course our own forces afloat. We're buying now, missile defense is for us, for so long was a development activity, and we're really now heavily into production for almost all of our systems, the THAAD, the TPY-2 radars, the various kinds of Aegis interceptors and so forth. And all of that is something that India may take an interest in. But my guess is that situational awareness would be the most natural place to start.
I'll take one last question because Dr. Carter has to leave.
Secretary Carter. Chris Castelli with Inside the Pentagon. I wonder if you can say who you expect to meet with over there in India, how much of the time will be spent on advocating for the U.S. fighter candidates, and can you say anything about what other stops, if any, you might be making on the trip?
Well, it's not finalized yet. I actually just saw the Wendy Anderson there has the trip plan. So I'm a guest. I don't want to volunteer an agenda there. I want to pin down anybody who would then feel they need to see me. I'm sure it'll be a good. Every visit I've ever had to India has been wonderful, and I think this will be terrific as well. I don't these aircraft. This is now underway. I think our people have explained themselves. I don't need to do that, and I don't. I think my principal interest in the moment in this and in all of our procurements worldwide is transparency, openness, so that everyone in India can see exactly what's going on, and whatever they pick, they'll have picked up for their own reasons on the merits. I mean, that's the important principle. That's more important than who wins, that it be done in that way. So that's the principal thing that I'll be stressing there. I'm really looking beyond that any one transaction and so forth. I'm looking to the future and to all the things, getting back to the question that was just asked, that we're not doing now that we might do in the future, to operational issues and so forth. I mean, the defense-industrial relationship is an important thing, but it's just one arrow in the quiver. And we'll be extending across the whole beachfront in the trip. I really do look forward to it. And I thank you, actually, for allowing me to come here, and thank you all for making it in through that really desperately difficult to navigate half-inch of Washington snow.
Well, let me, on your behalf and my own, thank Dr. Carter for coming here this morning, and to Wendy Anderson, who actually spent a lot of time putting this together. He has to go back to the Pentagon because he has a task that he has to complete today. He has to spend $2 billion. So I wish him well, and I hope he spends it well on our behalf. Thank you so very much for coming. I want to introduce the commentator who we have with us, Ben Lambeth. And again, Ben is, his bio is in your sheets there. You can take a look at it. I just want to say a few words personally about Ben. Ben, as I pointed out with Ash before, is an old friend of mine. In this city, you can never have too many of those. So I make it a point to make certain that my friends are always in attendance. Ben has been at RAND, he reminded me last night, for 36 years. And truly is the epitome of what RAND in its glory was. I knew Ben actually long before I knew him in person. I was a young undergraduate at the University of Bombay in the late 1970s. And I used to go to the USIS library in South Bombay to read a journal which at that time was a very serious journal, the Washington Quarterly. It still exists today, but at that time it was actual research journal. And in the early 1980s, I would be reading work by one man, Ben Lambeth, particularly on the Soviet Union and Soviet nuclear programs. And it was amazing that many years later, I actually ended up in the institution where Ben was truly a fixture of. And we were colleagues for a decade together at RAND. Ben is truly, the last of the Renaissance men, that men and women, I guess, that RAND has. They don't make him, they don't make them like him anymore. He still produces works at RAND that are not simply monograph reports, but serious books. RAND used to do that at one time. It stopped doing it anymore. I strongly urge you to read what Ben writes, because it's not writing on the fly, but it's really writing that pulls together a great deal of reflection and experience. There are two things that in particular I want to commend to your attention. He has in the process, he is in the final stages of putting together a book on Israel's experience of the use of air power in the war in Lebanon. It should be out once the U.S. Air Force and the Department of Defense make up its mind whether it meets all the security clearances and all the good stuff that usually happens. It's a first-rate book. It's not a small book. It's a large book, but it will be the definitive book on the subject. Second, and more to the point of this discussion, he has just completed a very substantial manuscript on the Indian Air Force. And that hopefully will be out sometime this year. It will be simply the best book on the Indian Air Force that has been published to date. And it's the best book not simply because it collates the information on the Indian Air Force that people ought to know about, but because Ben is actually a pilot. And among the things that he has done in between writing these tomes is actually fly fighter airplanes with different air forces around the world. And so he brings to the book not simply an academic's perspective, which is what I do, sitting in a cubbyhole, but as someone who actually drives these machines and, takes them to their limits. And so Ben's book on the Indian Air Force will be in many ways the best successor study to George Tanem's study on the Indian Air Force of two decades ago, both coming out of RAND, but this one comes from a very different perspective. It's very operational. And for those of you who are interested in air power in the subcontinent, I would really urge you to look for Ben's book, which should come out later this year.
That's encouragement to get it out quickly.
Yes, absolutely. And I have some role to play in that since I'm a reviewer. So that reminds me that that's something that I need to get back to him on as well. Well, I'm deeply grateful to you, Ben, for taking the time to come here this morning and to spend it with us. I was struggling to figure out who would be the best person to comment on a manuscript like this, because once you read this, you will discover that it is quite abstruse, at least in parts. And in Ben, I don't think we will have a better commentator. So welcome, Ben. On that note, I'm going to spend about 10 minutes, if I can, and just walk you through some of the salient themes in the monograph. Let me start by saying that the Merkur competition is going to be a very significant competition, at least for three reasons. One, it's the Indian Air Force's biggest fighter tender in a long time. And it's really important for the evolving character of the Indian Air Force as a warfighting instrument. the airplane that the Indians buy from this competition will be with them for the next 30 years. And it's going to be at least a third of the Air Force if the numbers in my book turn out to be right. Second, the winner in this competition, there's going to be strong economic impact because at least for the European participants, winning the outcome of this competition is going to have a consequence for their own viability and longevity, essentially as aircraft producers. We're entering a global aviation environment where the buys are going to be smaller, not bigger. And so outside the United States and the OECD, there are going to be very few countries that are going to be buying 200-plus airplanes anytime soon. And for smaller boutique aircraft producers, this becomes a very makes a very important difference to their viability. So how this competition comes out is going to have an impact, actually, on the global aviation industry, particularly in Europe. And the third reason, of course, is that the U.S. has very important stakes in the outcome. For the last 10 years, we have struggled to find, you know, to make the case for a strong U.S.-India defense partnership. And during the Bush administration, the decision was made to offer, in a sense, the best planes that we could muster and that were relevant to the medium-role aircraft that India is looking to buy. And so we have a stake that this come out in a particular way. Now, I'm going to, in my remarks this morning, I'm going to touch on five areas. I'm going to try and do that in 10 minutes, so forgive me. This is going to be truly a drive-by shooting in many ways. I want to talk first about the regional context of the acquisition. Second, I want to talk about the changing character of air warfare in the region and how this impacts requirements for the Merkur. I want to say a few words about the contenders, the six contenders that Ash Carter identified earlier on. I'm going to say something about how the government of India ought to think about the buy. This is obviously unsolicited advice, but, you know, I'll give it to them all the same. And then the last few remarks I'm going to make are on what the USG should do to ensure an American win if that is important to the United States. So let me start with the regional context very briefly. We have moved out of the scenarios of surprise attack in Southern Asia today. Surprise attack is really not the critical security challenge that defines warfighting in South Asia as it did for the first 30 or 40 years. The real challenge today is limited conflicts. And in limited conflicts, air power becomes the premier instrument of choice because it's flexible, it can respond rapidly, it can be used for as little or as much violence as a state wants to inflict. And so in this environment, the Indian Air Force is going to become essentially a very key component of India's national power. That's the good news if you wear Indian Air Force blues. The bad news is that despite the importance of the Air Force rising in this strategic environment in Southern Asia, the force capabilities in terms of numbers of the Indian Air Force have been dropping and have been dropping quite steadily. The Indian Air Force is supposed to have 45 combat squadrons. They have not had the resources to sustain those 45 combat squadrons for some time now. And so they've settled for a requirement of 39.5 combat squadrons, what we would think of as the authorized level. And yet, if you look at the numbers in the force, there are not 39.5 combat squadrons today. In fact, there are probably closer to 30 combat squadrons, and that number will continue to drop for a few more years before it starts picking up again. And this has real implications for strategic balances in the subcontinent. In the late 1980s, the Indian Air Force had a 3-to-1 superiority over Pakistan. Today, the Indian Air Force can barely muster 1.6-to-1 superiority over Pakistan. So that's been a very sharp decline over two decades. Vis-a-vis China, there was a time when, although the Chinese always had a larger air force, the size of the Indian Air Force and the quality of its airplanes were always larger. The size of the Indian Air Force was always larger than the high-end segment of the Chinese Air Force. Today, that has completely changed. The Chinese Air Force has first dropped in size from a 5,000 airplane force about 20 years ago. It's now somewhere in the region about 1,700 airplanes. But is moving to a point where the high end of the Chinese Air Force will be larger than the total force size of the IAF itself. in the years to come. So this is a very dramatic change in the air power balances. And this is something that India needs to think carefully about as it makes its Mirka decision. And so I have one very important piece of advice for the government of India in the book, and that is whatever you do, buy the airplane quickly, because you cannot afford to have four sizes continue to drop in the way that they have over the last 20 years. Second broad theme, the character of air warfare itself in South Asia is changing in very, very dramatic ways. The standard model of air warfare in the past was essentially air-to-air engagements within visual range, cued by ground control stations. So you had radars that basically picked up evidence of airplanes coming in. You had airplanes sitting on strip alert. The airplanes were then kind of sortied when you had evidence of intrusions. The airplanes would kind of go out to meet the enemy, usually within visual range combat, engagement, disengagement, return to base. That was pretty much the standard model of air warfare in the subcontinent, supplemented by local attacks on air bases to try and winnow down the number of attacking airplanes. This model is very, very dramatically changing. It's changing in multiple ways. First, the ground-based air defense nets are now being supplemented by airborne warning and control systems. So there is much greater information about air activity available to all the adversaries in the game. Second, it's no longer an environment where within visual range engagements dominate, because today Pakistan, China, and India all are integrating long-range, beyond visual range weapons in their air-to-air arsenal. And so what you're seeing is a steady shift towards an air environment that mimics the kind of air environment that the U.S. Air Force has, in a sense, practiced for, where you have aircraft that maintain constant combat air patrols, are sustained by supporting equipment like tankers, are directed by airborne warning and control systems that kind of loiter and patrol in the rear, and then vector these formations in a whole range of long-range engagements. Now, this changes the character of the kind of airplanes that you want to buy, because what it does is it puts a premium on having the best sensors to be able to detect these things at long distances. It puts a premium on having a force with great connectivity, because it's not enough to detect. You also want to be able to pass the targeting information very quickly to fighters. You want the fighters with the best long-range sensors possible, because even though AVACs have appeared in the continent, there may not be enough AVACs to maintain round-the-clock patrols. So long-range sensors on the aircraft become critical, and in particular for the Mirka competition, having AESA radars, active electronically scanned array radars, becomes critical. In fact, it's going to be one of the pivotal elements in the competition. Having long-range AAMs, that's air-to-air missiles, and then being able to merge all these new capabilities and new offensive and defensive maneuvers are going to become critical. So what is my recommendation to the government of India? And this, I have two recommendations. So the first is, please buy a single airplane, don't buy two airplanes, because there's always the danger that the government might think about splitting the buy and buy two airplanes in order to satisfy political exigencies. Not a good idea from the point of view of the Air Force, because it would essentially first make the problems of force diversity, which are already very problematic in the Indian Air Force, even worse. And I believe that the political gains from that strategy would also be relatively meager. So my second recommendation to the government of India is buy a single airplane, don't go with multiple buys and multiple vendors. And the third recommendation is buy the best multi-role fighter. Now, this is easier said than done. And so I want to spend a few minutes telling you about what I think of, you know, how do you think about the best? It's very important, I believe, to get the criteria for understanding the best right. And so I have identified four criteria that I think are important for the Air Force to think about. The first is having the best sensors in avionics, and equally importantly, having systems that are integrated. It's not enough to have the best individual pieces. They also need to work together well. Having weapons that essentially are suitable to the environment that India is going to face in the years to come would be the second. The third is, since air-to-air combat is still going to be relevant, having airplanes that have aerodynamic maneuverability that allows you to gain a warfighting advantage. And then finally, of course, different measures of mission performance, everything from range to being able to maintain readiness to being able to generate sorties, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's, of course, another set of criteria which are equally important, may not be as much to the Air Force, but certainly to the government of India. And those are three. The first is costs. What are the costs of the airplanes? Not simply in terms of flyaway costs, but life cycle costs. The Indian Air Force, too, is very attuned to the concept of life cycle costs. Issues relating to a transfer of technology. For India, buying an airplane is not simply buying a system to populate an Air Force inventory. For India, the MRCA deal is really an effort to revitalize the entire combat aviation base. And so the kind of transfer of technology that will be available will be pivotal in choosing winners and losers. And of course, the third criteria at the strategic level will be political considerations. Does this airplane, whichever airplane is chosen, does that help the Indian state build a new set of transformational relations with this partner country that supplies the airplane? And so political considerations will become very important for the government of India. It's not illegitimate for the government to have those considerations. Now, when one kind of looks at the basket of all these choices, you come very quickly to the conclusion, especially when you look at the airplanes carefully, that the IAF, the Indian Air Force, faces very difficult choices. Because it's not as if there is one airplane out there that simply stands out spectacularly heads and shoulders above the rest. These are all very, very efficient, very, very competent warfighting machines. But if the Indian Air Force is looking for what it thinks of as the break the mold airplane, the airplane that will really give it quantum increases in capability, then my argument is that there are choices to be made. And this is the way I think about those choices. When one looks at the MiG-35, for example, against the criteria that I identified, I find the MiG-35 to be the weakest of the contenders. It does not have the sensor suites that the Indian Air Force would like to see. It brings no new weapons to the game from an IAF point of view. It's a decent airplane where aerodynamic effectiveness is concerned, but there are no order of magnitude improvements. And its mission performance in terms of readiness, maintenance, traditionally has been horrible. And I'm not sure that the Russians have figured out how to build a machine that is really efficient in terms of spending more time in the air rather than spending more time in maintenance. So I think the Indian Air Force is unlikely to think of the MiG-35 as essentially the answer to its problems. Which takes you to the second airplane, the Swedish Gripen, which is a very, very impressive airplane. It's an impressive airplane for many reasons. One, it's extremely light. You know, it's a 16-ton or a 17-ton airplane. It's in fact so light that in the report I argue that the Indian government should consider it, should seriously consider it as a replacement for the light combat aircraft, which is the Indian indigenous airplane, which the last time I checked was not doing too well. Now, the big downside, the Gripen has one or two downsides. The big downside, of course, is cost. The Gripen costs an arm and a leg, certainly compared to the LCA. And that is something that, of course, the GOI would potentially be deterred by. The second limitation that the Gripen has is that its hot and high performance because of its engine output is not as good as the IAF probably requires. But if you look at the integration of the sensors, the integration, the situational awareness that the airplane brings to the pilot, its connectedness in the information warfare world, it is truly an impressive airplane. And I'll tell you, there are many fans of the Gripen within the IAF. The political advantages of a Gripen buy are very ambiguous from my point of view. I mean, Sweden has supplied some key technologies in the Indian defense sector, but whether the Indian state would find it important to kind of build new bridges with Sweden as a political partner, that that argument is still not very convincing to me. So I'm not sure the Gripen crosses the threshold in that, which leaves you with two baskets of competitors. You have the two other Eurocanads, the Rafale and the Eurofighter, and you have the two Americans, which is the F-16I and the F-18EF. Let me say a few words about the Eurocanads. In terms of technical qualities, I find the two Eurocanads to be extremely impressive machines. Their biggest limitation at the moment is that they do not have AESA radars that are operational. They essentially have AESA R&D programs, which, if all works well, somewhere down the line, will produce an AESA radar. And when you compare that to the two American competitors, that is the biggest liability going in, because the two American competitors not only have operational AESA radars, they actually have very sophisticated AESA radars. And the U.S. is so far ahead with respect to AESA radar technology. I mean, for those of you who follow this stuff, you know that we are already in our second generation of AESA radar deployment, not development, deployment. And so the AESA radars that are on the F-16 and F-18 are already just going in systems with orders of magnitude superiority compared to anything that you will find in the European competitors today. Having said that, however, when you look at the integration in the European airplanes, it is very impressive. Integration of sensors, the situational awareness, that is the information that it brings from all sensors to the pilot, very impressive, presented in very usable form. The weapons that they bring to the table are also very impressive, though there is some question mark about whether the best European weapons would actually be made available to India in case there was a European buy. So the European airplanes are certainly very impressive and formidable. What is their downside? Their biggest downside is cost. They are extremely expensive, both in terms of flyaway costs and only marginally less expensive in terms of life cycle costs. When you compare them to the American airplanes in comparison, the American airplanes win on cost grounds, both at the flyaway level and in terms of life cycle, just hands down. The American airplanes, however, are mature designs. And the big debate in India is how much do you invest in what is popularly seen as older American airplanes versus newer European airplanes? In the public imagination and in the imagination of various parts of the governmental decision-making community, this is the big trade-off. And one of the things that I do in this report is to actually look closely at this issue. And what I find, in fact, this is to my own surprise because I went in with a different set of prejudices into the research. But to my surprise, I discovered that even though the American designs are notionally older, when you measure them by warfighting capabilities, they are just as good, if not better, than their European counterparts. And so one of the conclusions in the report is that from the point of view of the Indian Air Force, there is absolutely no difference between a fourth generation and a 4.5th generation airplane. Because where it comes to having sensors, where it comes to having weapons, where it comes to integrating the information, where it comes to being able to put airplanes in the air at the lowest possible cost to the user, on all these issues, the American airplanes are not simply as good, but on many of these variables, actually better. And so I end up by basically making the case that the government of India ought to look seriously at the two American competitors. Now, let me say a few words about how the GOI should be thinking about the buy, because this really concludes the intellectual framework for my argument. So I start by basically saying that by a variety of technical metrics, which I explore at depth, you know, in depth in the report, the American airplanes are no slouches. When you factor that or marry that to issues of cost, I make the argument that they also come out to be quite advantageous on cost grounds. But that by itself, I don't think is enough to clinch the argument. So there's a third component that I look at, which is the IAF's current and future force structure and how this airplane, whatever airplane the Indians choose to buy, would fit into that force structure. And the storyline is essentially this, the IAF is looking to buy, or the IAF is looking to maintain essentially a three-tiered Air Force. A high-end component, which is today dominated by the Su-30 MKI, and which eventually will be replaced by the Russian-Indian PACFA, which is the Sukhoi stealth plane that India has committed about $4 billion to jointly developing. So that'll be the high end of the force. Then there's a middle of the force, which today is manned essentially by the Mirage 2000, and which will over time be replaced by whatever they buy in the Merkha program. And then there's the low end of the force, which today is dominated by the MiG-21, and if the Indian vision works itself out, will be dominated eventually by the LCA. Now, there are big imponderables here. The first imponderable is, what if the LCA does not deliver? If the LCA does not deliver, then the Indians have to think about buying not just one, but two airplanes. That is, buying a Merkha to fill in the middle and buying some replacement for the LCA. The other alternative, and I've urged the Indian government to think outside the box here, is to think not of a three-tiered Air Force, but a two-tiered Air Force. The U.S. Air Force, for all practical purposes in the air-to-air world, is a two-tiered Air Force, where you have a high end and then a relatively low end. And if you think of that, my argument has been, buy more Merkha planes in order to populate the middle to low end while continuing to invest in your Su-30s and then eventually the PACFA. The point I've basically made to the Indian government is that because of the transitions that are taking place in air warfare today, the steady shift towards stealth airplanes, this is not the time for the Indian state to be pouring enormous amounts of money into buying expensive fourth-generation aircraft. Or put it differently, to be buying the most expensive fourth-generation aircraft, no matter how good each of those aircraft look when looked at individually. Instead, what the Indian state ought to be buying is the cheapest, effective fourth-generation aircraft it can buy to populate the middle, while it actually starts aggressively planning for the transition towards stealth airframes at the high end, and if possible, stealth airframes at the middle and low end as well, because that's the future of aviation. So if you're thinking of the Indian Air Force, not simply today, but you have to think of the Indian Air Force in 2030, because whatever airplane they buy today is going to be in the force in 2030. My argument is, what you want to do is you want to think of the Merkha essentially as a bridging purchase to diversify the force, to bulk up your numbers, to get a very sharp injection of high technology quickly, but essentially buy time to move towards a transition towards stealthier platforms. And the stealthier platforms are coming at the high end. And if the PACFA project works itself out, that will become the stealthy platform that will dominate the high end of the Indian Air Force. But then to think essentially of stealth platforms at the lower end as well, and it was very gratifying to hear Ash Carter talk about the U.S. government being open to the idea of offering India F-35s at some point down the line. Now, there are, of course, grave questions about the future of the F-35 program itself, which, you know, Ash did not speak about. But the Indians are thinking about a low-end stealth fighter as well. So that's pretty much the way I've tried to conceive of the argument. Let me just end very briefly by saying, what should the USG do to ensure an American win? And I have three recommendations. First is, think seriously about transfer of technology, because having the best airplane by itself will not win the United States the deal. This decision will not be made by men in blue. It will be made by people wearing khaki kurtas in New Delhi. They don't understand the difference between AESA radars and PISA radars. What they understand is, are these guys bringing in the best they can bring in terms of tech transfer? Will this help revitalize India's aviation industry? So this is not an industry problem, it's a USG problem, because all tech transfer is ultimately controlled by USG regulations. So we need to be forward-thinking on this. Second, we need to really start talking to India seriously about fifth-generation fighters, whatever those fifth-generation fighters are, whether it's F-35 or helping India develop its own. And the third element is, of course, supporting India geopolitically, which this administration has done splendidly, continuing a tradition that has begun for the last 20 years. So we are good in the geopolitical support, but these other two areas, I think, are areas where we need to spend some time on. I'm going to end on that note. I'm going to invite Ben to make his remarks. And then what I would like to do ideally is to have a conversation with you all. I mean, this is not a subject that we need to teach you about, but if we can have a conversation about where India is going, I think it would be of profit to both Ben and myself. So thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, first of all, for your overly generous introduction. I'll keep trying hard to earn it. Good morning. In all my travels to Washington over the years, this is the first time ever the northbound metro broke what I needed it the most. So I'm getting my California appreciation training this week. A real honor that Ashley asked me to come up and share the podium with him on his report, which I read carefully in draft form, marked up heavily, and believe it really does a superb job not only of, I'm quoting him, contributing to a better understanding of India's security challenges in the U.S., as he wrote, but also to helping inform American policymakers with regard to our stakes in the MRCA competition, and not just by way of the business windfall that we would get, but more importantly, I think, in terms of how the bilateral security partnership, as Undersecretary Carter spoke to earlier, between our two countries would stand to be strengthened by a government of India decision to buy one of the U.S. products. Let me just, for the record, say up front, I'm here as Ashley's friend and colleague. I'm not speaking for the RAND Corporation or any of our sponsors. It's a subject I love. It's dear to my heart, and it's a treat to share my thoughts. I thought that Ashley's report covered the competition very well in both its technical and its political aspects. In fact, I would put to you that the ideal lineup to discuss the report would be a fighter pilot and a fighter design engineer, neither of which I am, but I will try my best to rise to that challenge. After Ashley asked me to share the podium, the first thought that came to me was, you know, what comparative advantage do I bring as Ashley's discussant? And as he mentioned, since I'm just about through with the book-length RAND report for the U.S. Air Force on emerging Indian air power, the title is India's Transforming Air Posture, an Emerging 21st Century Heavyweight, and it is. I thought maybe I could best help by, to start out with, providing some context on just what kind of an Air Force is that we're talking about that is contending to buy this aircraft, and then also say a bit more about what I see our stakes in the MRCA competition being in terms of the value added to be had from a strategic and security perspective if one of the two American contestants wins the nod. To start out with what we're talking about with regard to the Indian Air Force, it's my sense there is still a widespread impression in many quarters worldwide that because the Indian Air Force, still about 80% of its force structure is made up of second and third generation, some fourth generation Soviet and Russian combat aircraft, it's just another big third world Air Force, much along the lines of the other Soviet client states that we observe. That is not, I mean, nothing could be farther from the truth. It is the world's fourth largest Air Force, serving the world's largest democracy and its second largest economy, or second largest growing economy next to China. It has improved remarkably since the early 1990s in its combat capability, from being mainly just an army support entity of day clear weather MiG-21 class fighters to a true all weather day night precision standoff multi-role fighter force that could hold its own with any in the world. Back in the early 90s, it had no formal doctrine to speak of. Again, as I mentioned, it was just a support entity to the Indian Army. It has now become a truly modern force with independent strategic roles, first and foremost of which is being the principal executor of India's nuclear deterrent and retaliatory capability. It is also commanded and led by uniformly high caliber officers who are technically literate on a par with our own. I have spent quality time over the past 2 years with the past two of their serving chiefs and two previous chiefs of the air staff. I've also met, I think, the best of their successor generation. And I can assure you from kind of my perspective over the years that they could hold their own with any gathering of airmen worldwide. As Ashley mentioned, they operate without question the best fourth generation plus fighter in the world today, the Sukhoi, the Su-30 MKI. They brought eight of these aircraft to Nellis Air Force Base in August of 2008 at General Mosley's invitation when General Mosley was the chief of the air staff to participate in Red Flag for 2 weeks. They performed remarkably well. Their pilots and weapon systems operators were welcomed by their American counterparts as fellow airmen, as brother airmen. The Su-30 MKIs maintained a 95% fully mission capable rate throughout the entire 2 weeks, which was head and shoulders above the performance of any of the other contenders, not only ourselves, but a detachment of French Rafales and a detachment of F-15Ks from the South Korean Air Force. I would even say that, I mean, as I've gotten into my research, it has struck me that the Indian Air Force has, over the past 10 or 15 years, followed a transformationally developmental flight path, very much like the U.S. Air Force has over the past, since the Vietnam War, in terms of such considerations as size, force composition, doctrinal orientation, and breadth of missions performed. In an article in, I've forgotten the name of the journal, it was an Indian trade journal a couple of years ago, Ashley characterized our two air forces as natural-born partners. And I really do think, from my own impressions, that hit the nail pretty much on the head. To the second point that I suggested at the outset, having to do with what's in it for us in connection with the decision, Ashley commented in his report, and he mentioned fleetingly in his remarks, that the government in India will most likely evaluate the six contenders in terms of seven criteria. And I'll just tick through them. Sensors and avionics, weapons, aerodynamic effectiveness, mission performance, technology transfer, cost, and political considerations. And I think, as Ashley suggested in his remarks, if you look at all six contenders in terms strictly of the technical parameters, it's probably the Indian Air Force professionals will definitely rank order from one to six. And they're very, very good at that. But my sense is that the civilian bureaucrats and politicians who will make the final call will probably look across that spectrum of six contenders and call it a wash. You know, any of them, in a pinch, can probably meet the requirements of the Indian Air Force. So what that leaves us with, and I think more important, what it leaves the Indian government with, as the most probable factors determining how they're going to make the call, are those having to do with the extent of technology transfer they can expect to get, as Ashley mentioned, the assessed overall life cycle cost, and perhaps most important of all, the overarching political question of what India hopes to gain beyond just a new car in the garage, if you will, by way of a broader bilateral strategic and security partnership with the parent government of the winning contender. Ashley wrote, in this regard, that the deciding factors will probably be, and I will rank order those, strategic benefit, technological infusion, aircraft quality, and economic payoff, probably in that order. And that suggests to me that for the United States government, the considerations that matter really the most among those four factors are the first two, and that they are the strategic benefit that both India and we may hope to gain out of a U.S. win. And secondly, the extent of technology transfer that India can get based on what both U.S. law and U.S. security interests will allow for either of the two contenders to be picked, offered by the United States. So let me say just a few words about each of those two categories, and I'm going to be as quick as I can because we're running out of time. I would stress that both the government of India and the United States government should be mindful of the fact that, in contrast to all of the other four MRC offerings that are now in contention, only the two U.S. entries offer India not only a first-rate opportunity to recapitalize their fighter force with a world-class aircraft, but also the unmatched strategic value added that would come from a more closely cemented security partnership with the United States. It would mean, if they pick one of the two, not only a prospect for closer ties with either the U.S. Air Force or the U.S. Navy, depending on whether the Super Viper or the Super Hornet were picked, but it would also include some strategic side benefits at a higher level for both of the two governments. Those benefits, just to tick them off quickly, I see three in particular. First would be access to the American basing and spare parts infrastructure in the region, and also the American knowledge base in the region regarding both of those aircraft. Second would be regular opportunities for cross-training with either U.S. Air Force or U.S. Navy units in the region operating the same equipment. And most important of all, an inclusion by India into a serious, consequential, an unprecedented defense relationship with the United States. None of the other contender countries can offer that. All they can offer by comparison is simply a good business deal. And even as Ashley suggested with regard to the comparative cost numbers, they don't offer that. They don't offer that either. Given these incentives, it seems to me that any best effort the U.S. government would make to give the Indian civilian leadership every incentive to make the right call for one of the two U.S. contenders would have to do with the extent of technology transfer that they can expect to get. Now, I get out of my depth here very quickly on things like source code, and I would invite anybody from industry here to help shed some light on these issues. But I really do believe that probably the main sticking point, and this is from my own conversations with Indian Air Force leaders, both active and retired over the past 2 years, the main sticking point and perhaps even a deal breaker for India when it comes to our two offerings will have to do with access to the source codes for the two aircraft's digital data bus, mission computer, and integrated electronic warfare suite. Again, Ashley touched on this. This is not something that contractors have much of a vote over. It's really more a matter of U.S. policy and really U.S. law when it comes to the releasability of our most jealously guarded technology. On this point, I dug out a quote from back in 1995 from an informed U.S. Air Force officer who stated categorically, we do not release mission computer source code, radar source code, and electronic warfare source code, period. Okay, be that as it may, both the Indian Air Force leadership and the government of India have been adamant about the importance of sufficient releasability to meet their expectations. When I saw him last year in Delhi, the former chief of the Air Staff, Air Chief Marshal Fali Major, he told me directly that of all the six MRCA contenders, only the two U.S. contenders present this problem. And he added that no Indian government will tolerate directed constraints on the access that the Indian government is seeking. Where that leaves us with, again, I would leave it to those better versed in this issue area than I to shed further light. But it seems to me that it is an imperative for the U.S. government to apply all the creative imagination it can to find some mutually satisfactory way of squaring the circle so that India can get what it needs to make what it may be predisposed otherwise to go for an American contender, and at the same time protect what has to be protected on the American side. I had an email comment from Air Chief Marshal Major just a couple of weeks ago. I sent him my draft to comment on, and he wrote back. He repeated this point. He said it raised some contentious issues that bothered him, which could perhaps derail the existing strong Indo-U.S. defense relations. He was referring in particular to the Communications Interoperability Security Memorandum of Agreement and also the End-Use Monitoring Agreement, both of which have been very contentious. He said, these need to be resolved soonest. I say this because both sides have strong views on the subject, and this could delay or preclude our likely arms deals with the United States. I found it interesting that he referred to likely arms deals otherwise. Which again suggests that there may be a strong Indian Air Force predisposition in principle to go with one of the two American contenders if the technology transfer issues can be satisfactorily settled. My sense is it's not mission impossible. There was a senior manager from Hindustan Aeronautics Limited who was recently quoted. Actually, he spoke at a conference that I attended last year in Delhi on this issue, and he was clear that American technology constraints are driven not so much by contractor preference and even policy choice, but by law. And he, you know, one example is the congressional prohibition on sales of the F-22. It's just, we can't do it because it's illegal. But he said we can find a way to negotiate around it. I would leave it to people in the industry to sort of cast light on what that might mean in practice. But it suggests a willingness to meet halfway. One precedent for what it's worth, you remember back in 2003, 2004, when the Singapore fighter acquisition competition was underway, very much like what India is going through today, the F-15E was the dark horse. It was a contender against the Rafale and the Eurofighter Typhoon. And even though I think by the kind of analysis that Ashley presented, the F-15E, which became the F-15S, was the strongest offering on both performance and cost grounds, there was the big issue about access to sensitive technologies. And in the end, the government of Singapore went with the right choice, as did the Israeli government with the F-16I, and as a whole host of consortium countries have with the F-35. So if these demanding buyers can be satisfied, there must surely be a way that smart policy planners in the United States and Indian governments can find a way through that that morass again. And I think that's a good point for me to stop on. The clock is running out. I think it would be helpful to have Ashley maybe reflect a bit on some of these questions that I've raised before we get into a general conversation. I would also add, just as food for thought here, something that former Commander-in-Chief of India's Strategic Forces Command, Air Marshal Astana, he's an experienced fighter pilot, told me when I raised this with him last year. We had a long conversation, and it was his thought that both sides will gain. I'm quoting him. Both sides will gain if one of the two American contenders wins the competition. He also stressed that cost will be a major factor. And this is an area which I think all agree the United States, both of the American bids have a clear comparative advantage. And he said that if in the end the Indian Air Force acquires one of our two jets, they can teach us some things about it. And I believe that. If you go back to the wake-up calls that we got in COPE India 2004 and COPE India 2005, I mean, a very proficient, very capable Indian Air Force showed us some things about what the MiG-21 can do that we thought we knew very well, and we're surprised. So with that, let me stand down. Ashley, I think you really have produced a major contribution to the literature here. I learned from it, and it will give me some food for thought when I get on the airplane back for Delhi next Monday, and I will take as many copies as my bag will contain. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Please give me a couple of thoughts on your
But I want to open this up. I have a few things that I would on to Ben, particularly on the industrial cooperation issues and the agreements. But I want to open this up for comments and thoughts and anything I want. Yes, sir.
What would be the impact of Pakistan having the F-16, the previous ban on the F-16? Would that have an impact on procurement?
This, I think, is going to be one of the specific challenges that the F-16 faces, because there is a prejudice in India that you don't want to buy the same airplane that the other side has. And there are certain legitimate grounds for the prejudice. And the standard argument that fighter pilots will give you is, if it's the same airplane, then the envelopes are the same, the weaknesses and strengths are the same. There's no way in which you can overcome the other airplane through clever tactics, because assuming pilot quality is comparable, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's one catch, though, and this is something that I think Lockheed Martin and the U.S. government need to make the point more clearly, and that is the F-16IN, which is offered to India, is not the F-16 Block 50 that Pakistan has in its inventory. The F-16IN is actually a very different airplane. It's an airplane first with an AESA radar. It's an airplane that will come with the whole range of electronic warfare systems that simply are not in Pakistan's inventory. And the sum totality of capabilities in the F-16IN are unlikely to find their way to Pakistan anytime soon for a whole range of reasons. But the F-16IN is a bit of a chameleon. It's actually two airplanes in one. If you think of the F-16 minus the conformal fuel tanks, it's one of the most maneuverable fighters in the world. In fact, in my rank ordering, along with the F-18, by the way, the F-18 is also viciously maneuverable. But it comes second only to the Gripen where maneuverability is concerned. When you throw in the CFTs, the conformal fuel tanks, maneuverability degrades quite considerably. And that's not because of drag. In fact, Lockheed has done a remarkable job in the way they've shaped the CFTs. It's because of weight. It carries so much extra fuel that it becomes a harder airplane to turn. So in some sense, you've got to decide how you want to configure the airplane for the mission. You know, it's a little wrinkle in the F-16 iron story. Now, the Pakistanis don't have this problem because they have a straightforward Block 50 vanilla F-16. But that, I think, is going to be an issue that Indian planners will think about. And, I have no difficulty admitting up front that there is clearly a prejudice against the F-16 for that reason. But I hope that when they begin to look more closely at the Pakistani version, Block 50, versus the F-16IN, which is actually an advanced version of the Block 60 that we have sold to the UAE, that they will begin to see it for what it's worth.
Could I just add to that? I do believe, I mean, this is an important point. This may be the toughest sell that the Indian Air Force may have to its civilian masters to make the point that the F-16IN that's being offered, this is not your mother's F-16, as Ashley said. I mean, it's even a development beyond the F-16 Block 60, the EF that we've sold to the Emirates, which is with an ESA radar. It has capability that none of our own F-16s have. And yet you would not know that just to look at the jet. You could park a Block 50 and a Block 60 on the ramp. They look basically the same. So it will be a challenge to make that argument.
Yes?
Ashley, with the, you were mentioning earlier that we're all transitioning to stealth aircraft, and this MRCA is just transitioning to the F-35. I guess, why don't they just jump onto the F-35 now since we don't have any objections to it?
Well, it's a complicated question because Let me backtrack a bit. There is a body of thought in India that, in fact, is arguing that they should simply kill the Merca competition and go straight to F-35s. There are several issues with that as a strategy. One is we have not formally offered them F-35s. So certainly at this point in time, there is no F-35 offer on the table. That's just a practical matter. Second, because of where the F-35 is in its own development program, it's not an aircraft that will be available to India today. And if you look at the numbers that I was describing, even if the Indians were to join an F-35 program, they simply would not be able to envisage having F-35s in the inventory starting, say, 1 or 2 years from now. So as a practical matter, even if they bought F-35s, it would be some distance away, which takes us to the question of what do you use for bridging? And then, of course, when you think of it as a bridging capability, by bridging, I don't mean to say you just buy something in order to buy time. You do want to buy a decent airplane because it's going to be in the inventory for 30 years. So it's bridging only in a notional sense because you are moving to a different kind of architecture. And so from that point of view, they will have to think of an alternative, even if they have an F-35.
I think there's an even more compelling answer, and that is that right now, the fifth-generation fighter aircraft of record that the government of India is committed to is the T-50, the Sukhoi PAK-FA. I mean, they have a contractual relationship with Russia. They're committed to spend $4 to $5 billion on it. The aircraft actually, it made its first flight on January 29 of last year. It is in a flight test program. And that is the stealth, the fifth generation program of record. No one in the Indian government has even expressed an interest at this point in the F-35. My own sense, for what it's worth, is that it would behoove the U.S. government to let it be known that the aircraft would be available, particularly if the FGFA, the PAK-50, or the PAK-FA encounters developmental trouble.
Does the J-20 factor into this
role? Oh, I think the J-20 will certainly accelerate the Indian emphasis on stealth platforms even more. Because the assumption always was, yes, we know there's stealth on the horizon, but thankfully it's stealth right now in the hands of our friends. Now the J20 reminds them that stealth is on the horizon and it's not always in the hands of your friends. And so I think it will accelerate the drive to think seriously about a stealth platform. But the point that Ben makes, I think, is really important. You know, the PACFA is an impressive airplane, as to the degree that one can tell at this point. But it's still a developmental airplane. And like all technologies, I mean, we are seeing this with the F-35. There are so many technical risks involved, you know, in the technology as it matures. So to gamble on the fact that you will somehow have a, you know, a stealth fighter, you know, developed in Russia on time, on schedule, is a bit of a gamble. And if I was an Air Force planner, I would say, okay, I've put my first monies on that platform because it fits into my larger strategic plan, et cetera, et cetera. But I, by God, I really want to be thinking of a backup. And I think there is an opening here that we have, and it's something that, you know, I think we need to talk to DoD a little more. The Indian Navy is very interested in a U.S. fifth generation platform. And they're thinking of it primarily from a carrier point of view. And it's something that I think we need to look at because the Indians will buy, you know, additional carriers. I mean, they will build additional carriers in the years to come. And the big constraint they have right now is what airplane, you know, they'd put on those carriers. Now, the F-18 here looks very attractive because it's, you know, it's a airplane for all seasons and all reasons, I mean, in that sense. Because if you buy an F-18, you can have a land-based version and you can have a carrier-based version. Assuming that, of course, the flight deck is configured to take aircrafts of such weight. I mean, there are all kinds of issues there. But the Navy has certainly shown an interest in a fifth-generation U.S. platform. And I think they have, if I'm not wrong, they have actually issued an RFI. And I'm not sure whether we've responded, but it's something that we need to look at.
You know, just another problem with the F-35 as a fallback option is that the Indian Air Force, at least, has stipulated a two-crew, a two-seat requirement for their fifth-generation stealth fighter, which doesn't exist yet in the Russian platform. It's right now just single-seat aircraft. And it remains to be seen whether they can add that second cockpit without compromising the LO, the low observability. But the F-35 was designed and built as a single-seat aircraft, and that's the way it's going to be. There's no way that it will ever be a two-seater. Yeah. So that would be a limiting factor.
I also think from a force architecture point of view, and I discussed this towards the end of the report, the F-35 is, you know, if all goes well, it will be a great airplane. But it, the way I understand it, it's not our primary air-to-air combat platform. It will have air-to-air capabilities, but it was designed as a first-day-of-war air-to-ground platform. And so down the line, I see that as having some interesting advantages for India. But from an Indian Air Force planner's point of view, it will not replace the requirement for a stealthy air-to-air platform, which will be PACFA or, you know, something that looks like a PACFA. Jack.
Gentlemen, how does the U.S. government deal with the traditional view that will certainly be heard from the commentariat in India that the United States is unreliable? And therefore, we should not go with the United States because, albeit exaggerated, the U.S. is unreliable as a weapons supplier.
I have two takes on that. I mean, there is a large audience for this argument in India. And even as we speak, there are people who mouth this all the time. First, it's often a motivated argument because there are people who don't want to buy American for reasons that have nothing to do with the quality of goods or even the supply issue. So first, it's important to understand the politics of where these things come from. The second point I would make is that the U.S., the relationship of the past is not the relationship of the future. I mean, that, to my mind, is the critical thing that Indians need to appreciate. That if there is anyone who has demonstrated with clarity, you know, beyond doubt, is that the U.S. has gone out of its way in the last decade to show that it is willing to do things uniquely for India that are simply unprecedented. And I'm referring here to the Civilian Nuclear Cooperation Agreement. Anyone who doubts U.S. reliability ought to look at what the U.S. has done for the relationship since 2005. Absolutely. And to my mind, as the U.S.-India relationship deepens, And the point that Ash Carter made this morning is that history and latency are on the side of a stronger relationship because our interests, values, all that stuff. The incentives that the U.S. are going to have to be unreliable are sharply going to diminish. No one can give you an assurance that there will never be a moment in the future where the U.S. may not change its mind. I mean, no one can give you that assurance. I mean, you know, we are a sovereign country. India is a sovereign country. We have the right to change our mind about anything at any time. But if you think beyond the pure legal issue of do you have the right to change your mind and look more closely at what are the structural circumstances within which you're operating, you discover that there are very few conceivable circumstances where you might actually come to that point where the U.S. might have to yank the cord, you know, as has happened in the past. And so my bottom line is, you know, the relationship of the future is going to be radically different from the relationship of the past.
I would just add to that, you know, at the time the concern was most vocally raised, we still had a very distant relationship with India. And today there's a community of interest that didn't exist then, I mean, over China, just to name, you know, one dramatic one. And so, you know, you'd have to ask, what would the American incentive be to be fickle in this regard when, you know, really, our interests militate in the other direction. And now, the challenge is to persuade the Indian government of that.
And the other thing that I would say that, I mean, now we've had two presidents of different political persuasions in this country who have stated on the record that it is simply part of U.S. national policy to strengthen India's rise as an emerging power. Yeah. I mean, you know, if you can't believe the structural circumstances, then at least believe the things that, you know, we are willing to say publicly. I mean, those things have merit and value. Seema?
I want to understand this source code problem, which to me sounds like a major issue that you mentioned. And if India were to sign the two agreements that the U.S. is asking India to do, would that in any case, you know, change the scenario? Or, and because I'm not a defense correspondent, so I need to be explained this thing about the source code. If you're not willing to share this, how does it impair the plane's performance or maneuverability or whatever?
It doesn't impair the performance of the aircraft at all. The only thing it impairs is the extent to which India's defense industry can take technology, get into it, and adapt it and fold in indigenous capability of its own to modify. And again, I kind of get beyond my depth here. I think those two agreements have been signed.
No, actually, I think you're talking of the SSMOA and the BECA.
No, they haven't.
Let me take a stab at that. Oh, my God, that's trouble. The way I would think about it is this. There are some critical capabilities that the United States is not going to share with India, which is not going to share with any one period. These are the fruits of years of investment that the United States has made in critical capabilities, and it's what gives us our edge. We do not share certain categories of technology even with our closest treaty allies. This is not unique to the United States. I mean, this is the point I think Indian decision makers need to appreciate. There are core technologies that are embedded in the capabilities of the non-US competitors in this fly-off, which will also not be made available to India, period, no matter what people say. No matter what agreements are signed, no matter what agreements are not signed. Think about it rationally from the point of view of an OEM, original equipment manufacturer, right? They've put in so much of time, energy, and resources to build these capabilities. They are not simply, even for a 200-airplane sale, going to give away the crown jewels that essentially either destroy their commercial viability or create political constraints to their national users. That is going to be true for the United States and for everyone else. Very often the debate in India makes it look like, oh, this is a U.S. constraint. It really doesn't apply to anybody else. The fact of the matter is it applies to all. And so then what is the debate about? The debate finally is about one on the margins, which is, are you prepared to give me X? Are you prepared to give me Y? And there you may have, you know, some people prepared to give you a little more, some people prepared to give you a little less. But if you go in tomorrow and say, you know, I want source code for your AESA radar, which is the crown jewel in your avionics system, I'm sorry, but you're not going to get it. No one's going to get it. I mean, what we did, for example, in the case of the UAE sale, was to provide them with some intermediate capability, which was we gave them some capacity to upgrade their threat libraries in the radar independently. But to go out and, you know, ask people to divest themselves of what is decades of investment, I think it may be expecting a bit too much.
Actually, can I just make one point? I think there may be a little clarification order.
Claudio Lilienfeld, I think that the only clarification is simply that in some cases you're talking about actually transferring the capability. So you're actually transferring the pod or whatever else it is. You're willing to sell that. You're just not willing to transfer the intellectual property that underlies it.
Yes.
And the Russians and the Europeans are not willing to do that either? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I don't know what specific things the Europeans and the Russians are putting on the table. I'm just making the general point that if anyone tells you, because I've seen this often in the Indian press, that, oh, non-American competitors are willing to give us everything we need in terms of technology transfer. And I scratch my head and I say, say what? I mean, what is it that they are willing to give you? I want to know. The French have run a Mirage 2000 plant now in India. They've had Mirage 2000 planes. They've done servicing in India for, you know, 20, 30 years. The Russians have had MiG factories in India now for almost 40 years. If you go and ask HAL, if you ask the Indian Air Force, what has been the extent of real technology transfer? I think you will get an answer that will surprise you. Because essentially what you get is transfers of, well, you get mechanistic transfers of know-how. What India wants is transfers of know-why. And unfortunately, know-why is what people spend a lot of money acquiring. And there will be some available, but don't expect that it's going to come on a silver platter and, you know, just because you buy an airplane, you know everything about the innards of the airplane.
And if you ask another question, what is the opportunity cost and to whom of limits on technology transfer? For the Indian Air Force, virtually non-existent. I mean, they will get the equipment will work, they will be able to maintain it, it will meet their requirements. So then the question is, well, who benefits here? Really, the concern is more an industrial concern about getting access to, you know, core software information that could be used as a baseline for building domestic products on. And I suspect that could be negotiated around.
Well, and this will be the subject of negotiation. I can promise you it's not going to go away.
That could get out of hand, is all I'm saying.
Well, it could. I would just make the point that, you know, when you have to address the political issue, it has to be addressed on the basis of fact and not unreasonable expectations. So if you have a discussion at 80,000 feet where you start the argument by saying, but X is prepared to give us everything and you are prepared to give us nothing, then obviously this is not going to be a very productive conversation. I mean, one needs to actually sit down. And again, it's not a discussion, to be honest, that you and I can have from the outside. This is something that the government of India will have to negotiate with manufacturers, with the host countries intervening. This is at a level of detail that goes way beyond, you know, what you and me in the street will be able to judge. Nick?
Thanks, Nashley. Nick Khanna with the U.S.-India Business Council. I just want to build on this very discussion point, I think, Ashley, because when and try and marry the our U.S. technology release policies and the dimensions of where those actually sit to the Indian industrial capabilities. And, you know, we've looked at some of the capacity constraints. Given that you're going to have 18 in flyaway and then HAL's going to do, under joint production license, 108, you know, and this is arguably going to be the biggest offset obligation for any winner. $5 billion will be the offset discharge. Where do you see, you know, steps being taken by HAL, by the MOD with the new defense production policy, which was just announced? Do you see them taking you know, credible steps towards integrating the Indian defense industry, not just the DPSUs, but integrating and creating a supply chain that will support HAL in that endeavor. And is there more that the MOD and HAL need to do to be able to bring along some of, you know, India's shining private sector companies as well? Because that capacity constraint is a very real concern, clearly, for our two contenders, for Lockheed and for Boeing. It's a massive risk, if you will.
I this is a very important question, and it's a very difficult question to answer off the bat. I will just say, though, since this report was written, Indian defense procurement policy has changed in principle. Now we have to see how it's implemented. But they have made the offsets requirements now more generous from our point of view. And I think it's a very sensible thing they've done, because when I was writing the report and the existing procurement policy was in play, the requirement that the seller would have to invest 50% of the foreign exchange requirement in direct offsets, for me, my first thought was, even if one could come up with such a way of doing it, would India have the capacity to absorb those direct offsets? And I don't think it could. And I think India has realized now that it can't. And so the idea of not going to indirect offsets, but broadening the concept of direct offsets to say, no, but you don't have to do it necessarily just in defense. It could be in civil aviation, or it could be in other areas of the defense sector, I think provides an opportunity to, in a sense, spread the wealth. You know, it becomes more leavening. And so I think that's a very good first step. But there are two other steps that I think need to be taken to bring the process to its logical conclusion. One is, India has to look to its own private defense industry as becoming a supplier to the Indian national defense establishment in a way that it has not done historically. And you know what the problems are here, because the DPSUs have basically become a political pressure group who want to protect essentially their enterprise. To the degree that you get Indian private industry now competing with the DPSUs, I think the user comes out ahead. And so I think that's a step the government of India has to take. There's a third step, which I think is necessary, and that is removing the constraints on foreign direct investments, the capital constraints on foreign direct investment in India, because you really cannot expect genuine technology transfer if you tell American companies or European companies that you must bring your best technology, but you will be allowed to control only 26% of the investment you make. I mean, it's just laughable. I mean, you know, you're not manufacturing toothpaste. You're manufacturing high-end commodities that have huge R&D cycles, enormous, you know, gestation periods, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? So they've got to start thinking creatively about what is it that we need to do to make the investment environment more attractive so that people bring in investment, and then with investment will follow managerial expertise, technology, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, we are going down that path. I mean, we've taken the first baby steps in that direction. Let me just spread the questions around quickly, and I'll come back to you if you don't mind. Frederick, did you have a... Did you? Okay. Yashwant, please.
Actually, I have a very small question. In the summary to your paper, you said the search is entering final stages now. The search has been on for almost a decade now.
Yes.
And so when you say final, how close are we to it, and how much more time would it take? And you know the Indian system as well as anybody in this room.
I have more reason to be optimistic today than when the search began, and I'll tell you why. The field trials are over. The Air Force has done the job of providing the staff evaluation assessments. As we speak, the Ministry of Defense is actually looking at both the offsets packages that have been put on the table. They're examining the commercial offsets packages, and they are reviewing the technical assessments that have been produced by the Air Force. And the expectation is, when you come to this point, you're essentially moving to a down select or essentially a potential decision. And so the rument, you know, and this is in India, so everything is very flexible in terms of time, right? But the rument is that soon after Aero India, which will be in the next, you know, several weeks, the government of India will move towards a down select where it will shortlist a couple of candidates, maybe two or three, we don't know, and then quickly open the commercial negotiations. What I fear is actually not that the government of India will not come quickly to the commercial negotiations stage. I fear that the commercial negotiation stage will then drag on and take on a life of its own. I'll give you two examples which depress me. The commercial negotiations for the advanced jet trainer, which finally went to the Hawk,
20 years.
Took over 10 years to complete. The commercial negotiations for the Scorpion submarine took another decade to complete. So you may come all the way to the commercial negotiation stage, and you may still be, if you're unlucky, a decade away from getting the first airplane. Now, the problem is... Well, the problem now is that if you are an Indian Air Force manager, you need to be making the most persuasive case you can to the government of India about the consequences of what that timeline means for your force structure. Because if you look at the numbers and if you look at the way the force levels are dropping and they do not get these airplanes into the force soon, you're going to talk of a very dramatic change in the air balance. And then, you know, you get to questions about national security responsibilities and all kinds of other things that Indians are better.
It raises a question of how much of a voice in what could be seen as a borderline emergency force structure situation that the Indian Air Force would have. I mean, when I spoke with the Air Chief, Air Chief Marshal Nike last February, I asked him, when you go to bed at night, what do you worry about most? And his immediate answer was force structure. Our squadron strength is dangerously low. We need to recapitalize the force, and we need to do it now. I mean, there was a real tone of urgency there. Unfortunately, the Indian uniformed services don't have a compelling vote, but this is a compelling concern.
And I think this is, again, a subject that will be discussed. I mean, not only between us and India, but, I mean, our European friends will be also making the same argument. So I think at a political level, there's an awareness. The question is they have to move with some alacrity to bring it to a close. We are exactly 1 minute past time, so I will entertain one last question before we adjourn for the day. So you get the last one in again.
So this is kind of based on like what we were talking about earlier about the PACFA, right? Okay, hypothetically speaking, I mean, like they're getting this PACFA, the two-seat version. They worked out all the issues with the two seats.
It hasn't been done yet. I mean, the aircraft has not been designed. That part of it has not been designed.
Yeah, I know that part. I'm just saying, it's like, okay, and they got the F-35s as their, you know, like, second-tier aircraft. Is the PACFA really as advanced, even remotely, like, when it's finished, as the F-35 is? I mean, sure, aerodynamically, perhaps not, but, I mean, like, I was talking to a very senior Air Force source, his boss's 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 boss, but some very high-ranking Air Force official, and he was saying that we're decades ahead of anyone for stealth, and we keep pushing the envelope forward. I mean, is the PACFA anywhere remotely close to...
I think the answer really is it's to be determined yet. I mean, it's a very, very basic, vanilla, you know, demonstrator prototype. The Soviets, the Russians have never shown any great adeptness at this technology before. We'll see. It's being touted as an F-22 counterpart. I mean, checks in the mail.
We shouldn't be unkind to non-operational aircraft, right? I mean, this plane is not in Russian Air Force service. It's flown once. There's a demonstrator. You know, it could be a great airplane. But there is simply no way to tell what its future is. If you're just looking comparatively about U.S. advantages and stealth vis-a-vis the competition, I mean, there's absolutely no doubt.
It took 15 years from the first flight of the F-22 until it went initial operational capability in 2005, and it's still improving. So you don't do these things overnight.
Absolutely. And so I wouldn't be claiming that this is the answer to all their problems. And I think the Indians know that well, too, but they have several calculations in mind. The industrial base calculation is a very important one to them because they've made the judgment that the Russians are more likely to give them access to technology which, even if it is not cutting edge, is better than what their immediate competitors will have. And it's not a bad judgment for them to make because, okay, it's not F-22 quality, but if it is something better than what their immediate adversaries have, then going with the Russians is not a bad bet. I think that's one calculation. The second calculation is that the Russian Air Force And Russian aviation industry is, to put it mildly, in a lot of trouble. And so this is an opportunity for India to, in a sense, you know, make some gains while the Russians still have the need. And Russian calculations are that they use Indian financing, again, as a bridging device until such time as the Russian Air Force can go out and buy large numbers of airplanes that would keep their own industry going. So there's, in a sense, a marriage of necessity here that is taking the two sides together. And again, I think their expectation, the third point, is that they don't expect that the U.S. will suddenly turn around and give them everything they want. So it's a question of, in a very competitive political environment, where can you get the best sale? And, you know, if this allows you to take one step forward, you know, it's an investment. My only point is, you know, the proof of the pudding always is in the eating. So you can invest the money, but only time will tell whether this is an airplane that will deliver. And so from that point of view, the diversification concept of, you know, going outside Russia, going out to other partners, becomes absolutely, absolutely critical.
The other downside there is a growing, I've sensed, disinclination on the part, at least, of the uniformed Indian Air Force to keep putting up with the highly unreliable, increasingly unreliable Russian product supplier.
And it's not just the Air Force. It's actually all the three Indian services and the experience they had with the Gorshkov.
And I think that was a real eye-opener. One major hit against the MiG-35. Apart from the fact that it's not a mature aircraft.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, on that cheery note, my friends, thank you very much for coming. I hope the weather this afternoon is a little better so that you guys can get back home. They are threatening to give us 6 or 8 inches of snow.
It's not the forecast,
I believe. But please be safe. And thank you for coming. We will see you again. Take care.